stands against the nation, against the republic and the constitution. The Taliban must realize that we are committed to defend our land.
Referring to the recent war crimes committed by Taliban, locals here say, unlike the beliefs of U.S. Special Representative for Afghan Reconciliation Zalmay Khalilzad, who had said that Taliban has changed, the recent advances of Taliban proved that they are still following a dogmatic ideology. Some of the displaced Afghans accused Taliban militants of committing war crimes during their assaults on districts and provincial capitals over the recent month. They say the Taliban have killed civilians, used them as human shields, and destroyed their houses. The only way against the militants' violence, they say, is to resist. Sayed Amin Alami, Kabul.
Britain is known to be the hub of terrorist and corrupt fugitive political leaders fled from Pakistan. This is London residence of Altaf Hussain, a leader of Karachi-based ethnic political party. Back home, Hussain was convicted on terrorism and murder charges. Nonetheless, UK never handed him back to Pakistan of being what many believe an intelligence asset of British secret services. This is Ishaq Dar, the former finance minister who fled from Pakistan in 2018 to avert prosecution on money laundering charges. And here comes the former Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif, who has been staying in these luxurious flats, which judges back in Pakistan found were purchased with the looted public money. However, pressure from Islamabad has now compelled Britain to change its long-held pro-fugitive policy after London decided to expel Nawaz Sharif. His request to further stay in the UK was rejected by Britain. His Pakistani passport is already invalid after Islamabad refused to renew it.
The UK government has been under intense pressure, not only from Pakistan, but various other countries whose fugitive leaders have been living in UK for a long period of time. The UK government was under great pressure and under great criticism. And that could be a reason that the UK government basically did not allow Nawaz Sharif to stay on or extend the visa of Nawaz Sharif to stay in UK.
Nawaz Sharif fled Pakistan after plundering public exchequer. He should now come back to Pakistan and must return the money he looted, and after this he can comfortably stay at his home in Pakistan.
Sharif was convicted and sentenced for 10 years on money laundering charges, but was released from jail in November 2019 only for medical treatment for a few weeks. However, since then, he has been residing in London despite repeated court orders to return home to face trial of corruption cases. The former Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif is fast running out of his legal and political options after Britain decided to expel him. One of the choices, analysts believe, is to seek shelter in an Arab country after exhausting his all legal options to delay his expulsion from the UK. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
Pakistan's president, foreign minister and others joined this rally in support of the people of Kashmir. The rallies were held in Pakistan to mark the second anniversary of India's, what Pakistan says, illegal move to revoke the special status of the disputed Kashmir region. India, on August 5, 2019, abrogated the Article 370 of the Indian Constitution that granted special status to the Jammu and Kashmir region. Pakistan rejected the move as a violation of the UN Security Council resolutions that seek a referendum to decide the final status of Jammu and Kashmir.
I want to assure my Kashmiri brothers that Pakistan will continue to support the people of Kashmir for their right to self-determination. We will continue to support Kashmiris till they get freedom.
Separately, Kashmiri leaders also took to the streets in Islamabad. The All Parties Hurriyat Conference staged a protest not far from the Indian High Commission in Islamabad.
We, the Kashmiris, not only in occupied Kashmir, Azad Kashmir or in Pakistan, but over the world where the Kashmiris are present, they are making this day as a black day. Why we are making this day as a black day? Because against the will and wish of the people of the Kashmir, India has abrogated its articles.
Protesters condemned the Indian policy towards Kashmir and vowed to continue their struggle until Kashmiris get their right to self-determination.
Kashmir is a disputed territory as per the United Nations resolutions. The resolutions have been passed and at the behest of the India. It was India who took the Kashmir disputed to United Nations. And it is India, it is the then Prime Minister of India, Jawaharlal Nehru, who in his communique to Pakistan said, we do not believe in forced marriage and Kashmir will be given right to self-determination.
Kashmir remains at the heart of tensions between India and Pakistan. The dispute dates back to the partition of the subcontinent in 1947. Both countries have fought wars over the only Muslim majority state controlled by India.
Tensions between India and Pakistan have further deepened since India revoked the special status of Kashmir. Pakistan insists India has to reverse the changes for any talks. India, however, is defending the changes, calling it as its internal matter, and hence the deadlock. Kamran Yusuf, Islamabad.
The brutal battle between Taliban and government forces has intensified recently, with each side struggling to gain more area under their control. Top military officials in southern Helmand province have urged the residents of the city of Lashkargah to evacuate their houses. Reports say Afghan forces are planning to launch a heavy attack on Taliban inside the city of Lashkargah, who use residences of locals as human shields.
We had announced that if a single Talib arrives in Lashkargah city, he will be killed. Even if 1,000 of them arrive, we will kill them all. This fight is not ours. They are Takfiris and slaves of Punjabis. They aren't Afghans. Our fight against them is a pure jihad, and we will continue this holy jihad with a strong will.
Taliban has in recent weeks launched more attacks on provincial capitals, mainly in southern and western Afghanistan. This comes as many here believe neither the government nor the Taliban will achieve their goals to take full control of the country via insisting on further war. They say negotiation is the only solution to resolve the conflicts.
Today, the ancient city of Herat is under attack, and the war has reached inside people's houses in Lashkargah of Helmand. Meanwhile, violence is spreading across the northern Taliban city and other areas. We still hope to reach peace through responsible moves by the government and Taliban.
Based on official figures, over 1,000 Taliban militants have lost their lives in a series of attacks carried out by Afghan air and ground forces backed by local armed fronts since last week. Afghan forces increased their attacks on Taliban militants and liberated some of lost areas, including Nijrab and Talaobarfak districts in northern and northeastern Afghanistan. Afghan President Ashraf Ghani recently called on the entire nation to establish a united national resistance front against the Taliban. He argues that since the Taliban have put military victory on the top of its priorities list, the time has come to talk to militants with guns and resistance. Sayed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
British Muslim advocacy group CAGE is preparing to go to war with the British government after announcing a legal bid against Education Minister Gavin Williamson over what they call discriminatory guidance to school leaders on Palestine. CAGE say the letter issued by Williamson on May the 28th amounted to a disgraceful censorship of political dissent in schools and discriminated against students by infringing their rights to freedom of expression.
CAGE has seen nearly 50 cases of people, of students, who have been targeted in their schools for speaking openly about Palestine and defending the rights of the Palestinian people to defend themselves against a system of apartheid and oppression and occupation.
The government's crackdown on Palestine solidarity in UK schools occurred during the huge global outrage over Israel's relentless attacks against worshippers at the Al-Aqsa Mosque and civilians in Gaza last May. Williamson's letter warned teachers to remain impartial on the conflict, but also warned of concerning rise in anti-Semitic incidents. However, Cage believed this is censorship cloaked by bogus accusations of anti-Semitism.
It is definitely becoming more the case that speaking on the issue of Palestine, advocating for the rights of the Palestinian people, exposing the crimes of the Israeli apartheid regime, these are becoming increasingly issues which are criminalized, issues which are securitized, dealt with very punitive measures, whether in schools, whether in the public space, or the debate about it is completely hounded out of the public space, such that these issues are silenced and they are unheard.
Cage are confident of success, as they believe that the government's position on this topic won't hold water if confronted in the courts. And many people are hoping for success here, as the way things are going now, many critics claim and fear that it could become essentially illegal to support the Palestinian cause publicly in the not-too-distant future, unless court battles like this are won now. Robert Carter, London.
Thousands of Lebanese commemorated the first anniversary of the catastrophic explosion which rocked Beirut. Accountability and justice was the main demand of the families of the martyrs.
August 4 should turn into a historic day by holding criminals accountable. The criminals who brought the ammonium nitrate to the port, they killed our children. I lost my only son because of their corruption.
I lost my brother in the blast and lost my mother only 2 months later. She died because of her grief for her son. I want justice for the sake of my brother and my mother. We want justice and we want to see everyone connected with the crime being put on trial.
On August 4th, 2020, a stockpile of ammonium nitrate fertilizer, which was stored without prudence, exploded, becoming one of the largest non-nuclear blasts in modern history, leaving over 200 people killed and thousands injured. The state of mourning for those who fell on the Beirut port explosion is still well alive in the hearts and minds of the Lebanese people, yet justice for the victims still seems out of sight. Yet mourning rallies quickly turned violent after some protesters tried to break into the parliament building. Security forces fired water cannon and tear gas at stone-throwing protesters. Several people were injured. In parallel with the protests, a virtual conference was held in support of Lebanon, where Lebanese President Michel Aoun said the quest for truth and full justice is still the main claim of every Lebanese.
I have already committed before the Lebanese to serve justice and hold accountable everyone whose involvement is proven by the investigation. Today, I restate my pledge that no one is above the law, no matter how high they may rank. Let justice go all the way in probe and the trials.
Aoun stressed that the funds given to Lebanon from the International Monetary Fund must be spent in the best way to face the collapse and embark on reforms, one of which is forensic auditing. She highlighted as very significant. This event comes as Lebanese officials are yet to form a cabinet. Demonstrators' anger is not only at the injustice in the Beirut port case, but at the ineffectiveness of the political class in dealing with the crisis. Mariam Saleh, Beirut.
Ebrahim Raisi was sworn into office as Iran's new president, prospect of change and resolutions to make Iran a better place to live. 115 heads of state and political officials from 73 countries attended the inauguration ceremony held in Iran's parliament on Thursday. With Judiciary Chief Ghulam Hossein Mohseni Eji on his side, Raisi pledged to protect the constitution and to serve the country and the Islamic establishment.
I, as president, swear to God Almighty before the Holy Quran and before the Iranian nation that I will safeguard the country's official religion and the establishment of the Islamic Republic and the country's constitution.
Ebrahim Raisi won the 13th presidential election on June 18th with a landslide, garnering 64% of the votes. His predecessor, Hassan Rouhani, left office with a pile of unresolved political and economic issues on the table, from snowballing inflation rates to the unconcluded nuclear talks with world powers. The 8th Iranian president vowed to fix all those issues, but he said he will not tie the country's economy to the nuclear deal.
Sanctions against the Iranian nation must be lifted. I will support any diplomatic process that would fulfill this goal. Meanwhile, the Islamic Republic of Iran regards its neighboring countries as its kin. So our first and foremost priority will be to upgrade our ties with our neighbors.
As has been the custom for any incoming administration, Raisi was endorsed by Iran's leader Ayatollah Khamenei on Tuesday. Now, after taking the oath of office, Raisi will have to name his cabinet members, who will then show up here in Majlis for a vote of confidence from lawmakers.
Coming from the Persepolis camp, Ebrahim Raisi holds different, if not opposing, views compared to his pro-reformist predecessor, Hassan Rouhani. So something like clinching a deal with the U.S. as the ultimate way out for Iran's ailing economy is not expected to be on top of his agenda. As the new president says, he will find new destinations to fix the economy. Yusuf Jalali from the Iranian parliament in Tehran.
Hi, good morning.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning.
Morning, sir.
Half a kilo of halim, please.
Hi, sir.
Hi, Kitty. Good morning.
Number one, hands up. Number two, hands on the waist.
Hi, good morning.
Hi, good morning.
Get ready for jogging to warm up.
Hello, good morning.
Hello, good morning.
One loaf of well-baked bread, please.
In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who allowed none to witness when He created the heavens and the earth, and who took no helper when He authored the spirits. He has no associate in divinity and no support in unity. Tongues fall silent before the limits of describing Him. Intellects fail before the core of knowing Him. Terrents fall low in awe of Him. Faces are humbled in fear of Him. And everything mighty yields to His mightiness. So to Thee belongs praise again and again, well measured
continually and methodically. And may his blessings be upon his messenger endlessly, and his salutation everlastingly, eternally. O Allah, make the beginning of this day of mine righteousness, its middle prosperity, and its end success. I seek refuge in thee from a day whose beginning is fright, and whose middle is anxiety, and whose end is pain. O Allah, I pray forgiveness from thee for every vow I have vowed, and every promise I have promised, and every pledge I have pledged, then fail to keep for thee. I ask thee concerning the complaints of thy servants against me. If there is a servant from among thy servants, of a handmaid from among thy handmaids, who has against me a complaint, because I have wronged him in respect to himself, his reputation, his property, his wife or his child, or because evil words I have spoken about him in his absence, an imposition upon him through inclination, caprice, scorn, zeal, false show, bigotry, whether he be absent or present, alive or dead, such that my hand has fallen short and my capacity has been too narrow to make restitution to him or to annul my obligation to him, I ask thee, O he who owns all objects of need which are granted by his will and hastened to his desire, that thou blessest Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, peace be upon them, and makest the one I have wronged satisfied with me in the manner that thou willst, and givest me mercy from thee. Forgiveness decreases thee not, and giving injuries thee not. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, give me on every Monday two favors from thee: the facility to obey thee at its beginning, and the favor of thy forgiveness at its end. O he who is Allah, and none other than whom grants forgiveness for sins.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio. The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, the West Asia region is tense after Israel has initiated air raids against Lebanon, and the Lebanese resistance Hezbollah has responded by firing a barrage of rockets back at the regime in the occupied Sheba farms. Now, the equation in the region has transitioned as Israeli aggression is immediately met by the resistance, which responds accordingly. Another significant variable this time around seems to be the unity of the resistance front against the Zionist regime will be looking at all of this on the spotlight. First of all, I'd like to start off in Beirut with Press TV's Mariam Saleh. Mariam, thanks so much for being with us. Well, fill us in on the situation, of course, even as we're talking right now. Said Hassan Nasrallah is finishing his speech, but tell us about the significance, the points, some of the points that he made about what has happened.
Yes, of course, he gave very significant points when it comes to the issue of retaliating and confronting Israel. He stressed, of course, the fact that we do have a new regional equation, which would, of course, lead to a solidarity between all of the resistance groups, but he has spoken about this extensively before. Today he focused a little bit more on exactly what happened on the Israeli shelling of areas, and this is the first time in 15 years that we have a shelling from the Air Force, from the Israeli military Air Force. And that is why he said that Hezbollah was quick to respond, quick to make sure to take things back to the deterrence equation that was sustained since the end of the 2006 war, which lasted for 33 days. As you know, now we are commemorating that event. It began in July and ended in August. So therefore, Sayyid Nasrallah also explained why Hezbollah was quick to respond, why he has not retaliated, for example, for the martyrdom of certain fighters that were killed, whether in Syria or on the border with Lebanon during protests in solidarity with Al-Quds, the Sword of Al-Quds. He said that this is only to stress the fact and tell the Israelis that it is forbidden to launch the shelling from your air force, whether even if it is on open territory. As you know, the Israelis launched on Thursday some shelling in open territory. Therefore, as Hezbollah was quick to respond, also on open territory in the occupied Shebaa Farms, but he also stressed that next time it will not be only in the Shebaa Farms. It could even be in targets in occupied Palestine or in the occupied Golan Heights.
Mm. And I thought it was interesting, Mariam, one point that also he made was that the resistance initiated that attack during the day because they didn't want to initiate terror against civilians, the opposite, of course, of what the Israeli regime did and, of course, initiated those attacks on Lebanon in the middle of the night. Thanks so much for that update out of Beirut. That's Mariam Saleh. And now I'd like to welcome my guests to the program. Another guest, author and journalist Jim Kavanaugh out of New York. And historian and journalist Brett Yonkers out of Halset. Thank you both for being with us. I'm going to start this off in New York with Jim. Your take, Jim, why do you think that Israel initiated this attack on Lebanon now?
I'm not sure. You know, as your correspondent said, it seems to have been an attack on an open area, which, you know, doesn't seem to have much rationale to it. The response by Hezbollah also was an open area. I think they were trying to provoke Hezbollah into a response. This is the first time in 15 years they've claimed a rocket attack against Israel, and they made very clear, we deliberately put it into an open area, et cetera. And I think really what you have is Israel is dying to get into war with Lebanon, with Iran. And they're trying to provoke something, I think. So generally speaking, I think that would be, you know, their stance after the supposed missile attack or the drone attack on the ship in the Gulf was we have to go to war with Iran. And they're trying to get the Americans to go along with that. So I think they're hoping to provoke something that would be a casus belli, that they could present as a casus belli to the world.
Brett, your thoughts on that. Do you think that Israel wants to go to war on Lebanon?
Well, I think this is definitely a strong possibility. We have to bear in mind that Israel itself is coming out of years of political strife and internal struggle within the Zionist entity itself. When you read mainstream media in the West, they often like to talk about the fact that Lebanon is mired in political strife and infighting on the political level, but the same goes, of course, for the Zionist entity itself. They have had several elections in the span of just a couple of years. And eventually they had to find a form of unity government in order to get Benjamin Netanyahu out, a unity government with eight parties that have a very fragile balance right now, which has seen Naftali Bennett come to power, but on a very fragile and very shaky ground that he is standing on. And in fact, the issues that have been plaguing the Zionist entity have been so big that in many cases during these elections, they didn't even talk about what to do with Palestine, what to do with the resistance, because they were too busy talking about the internal actual struggles that plagued people over there. So from that point of view, it is very important, I think, for a Zionist politician, especially an aggressive hawkish politician such as Naftali Bennett, to try to lure all the attention away from the internal problems and struggles of his colonial regime and instead focus the attention on a potential foreign war that he's probably hoping to bring to a swift and successful conclusion. This is playing by the book that has been going along for hundreds and hundreds of years, of course, especially in imperial politics, is whenever you have internal domestic struggle, try to find an external enemy and go to war. The United States has been doing that for nearly 300 years now, and it has at times really worked in order to save politicians' political career. And this is something that I think Naftali Bennett is trying now as well. Mm-hmm. Added to that, of course, there might be something to it that it's the 15th anniversary of the 2006 war in which Lebanon, led by Hezbollah, of course, dealt a sound defeat against the Zionist forces. And they are now, of course, celebrating this. So what better time to try to lure Lebanon into another war from the Zionist point of view than during this 15th anniversary? This might also be somewhat of a symbolic gesture on their behalf.
Okay, well, Jim, what about that, what Brett said? Because if that's the case, he talked about in basically uniting the people at home with a foreign war. But the other side of that would be Hezbollah is not an easy target, obviously. Tel Aviv saw that in 2006, and now if we fast forward 15 years later, Hezbollah has had a tremendous amount of experience now in dealing with Syria and elsewhere. Do you agree that Tel Aviv is willing to risk whatever it has to take on Hezbollah and its allies?
I think they're in a quandary about that. Yes, you're absolutely right. Hezbollah, they perceive Hezbollah as a threat now because they're afraid that Hezbollah has precision missiles, and they very well might, and they have a lot of missiles anyway, and they know they have missiles that can hit anywhere in Israel. And it's quite clear that if there's an attack on Iran or Lebanon, Hezbollah is going to launch missiles that will strike the heart of Israel. And Israel they really don't know what to do about it, because on the one hand, they're watching them get stronger, so they think, we have to do something. We have to go out and attack them. But they also know if they do, they might get hit very strongly. And that's why there was a little dance here where the Israelis themselves kind of pulled back at the end and said, okay, you know, we're going to accept this. We're not going to go any further. But what they want to do is they want to find out what the capabilities of Hezbollah are. And they want to destroy Lebanon. They want to try and get rid of Hezbollah with financial crisis and with economic siege, which is what they're doing. You know, all this business about we've got to reform Lebanon. Lebanese politics do have to be reformed. But what the Israelis and the Americans mean by that is you've got to get rid of Hezbollah. So they're trying on all fronts to get rid of Hezbollah, to weaken Hezbollah. But they're also, and they have been for years, trying to get the United States to agree with them to attack Iran. Now, and that's why they keep saying that. So this is really part of a strategy that's difficult for the Israelis to negotiate, because they're already at the point where they're going to be hit hard. You know, and as one Iranian commander had said at some point, you know, when the missiles start raining down in Tel Aviv, you're going to see a lot of people going back to Brooklyn. And so this is something that the Israelis can't take, but they can't just sit back and they feel like we can't just sit back and watch Iran and Hezbollah get stronger, because we want to be in the position where we can do militarily whatever we want to any country in the region that we want. We can bomb Syria every day. We can blow up Iranian tankers in the Gulf, you know, but they can't do anything to us. And Hezbollah is saying to a certain extent with this, look, we're willing to attack you. We're not going to be shy about saying we sent these rockets. So Israel has to figure out what to do about that. And mm-hmm. It's a quandary for Israel.
What about, Brett, the difference between Hezbollah 2006 and Hezbollah 2021?
there is the difference between the two is, in, I think, in such a way, in terms of military capabilities, that it would be the capacities of Hezbollah right now in terms of military and political strength would be almost inconceivable, I think, to a and to an onlooker back in 2006. There have been studies done into the military power, or at least estimates into the military power of Hezbollah, that say that the Hezbollah rocket and missile capacity is on par with that of an average NATO member state, of course, not taking into consideration the military powerhouse of the United States itself. So this is Hezbollah is by itself has a military strength of a small country. They have the support of an actual country of the majority of an actual country of Lebanon, of the Lebanese people. They have support across sectarian lines, across ethnic lines, across religious differences, as a almost universally respected member and leader locally of the resistance against Zionism. So this power that Hezbollah has been showcasing, I think, and has been building up the past 15 years, is of such an extent that I think that even the Israelis themselves have massively underestimated this. Indeed, I agree with the other guest. Indeed, what has been said is they're sort of somewhat testing the waters, and they're seeing how strong exactly Lebanon is. But I think we have seen by the fact that the Israelis they attack Lebanon, but they make sure to attack in an empty spot first to see what the reaction will be. I think they are, at the same time, they want to be hawkish, they want to be aggressive, but at the same time they are scared, because I think deep down they know that if they wanted to take on Hezbollah one-on-one again, like they tried and failed in 2006, they should have done this like 10 years ago. They shouldn't have waited this long. And because what happened in the meantime, of course, Shahid Qasem Soleimani happened, the resistance in Syria happened, the massive Iranian support build-up for the resistance in Lebanon and in Syria itself happened all in the past couple of years and has massively bolstered the resistance units in Lebanon itself and across the entire region. So the Israelis are really starting to come to terms, I think. The military strategists, they know deep down, of course they want to say it, but they know deep down that the prowess of on the military battlefield of Hezbollah is of such an extent nowadays that they can't expect to just go in there and fight them in the way that they were hoping to do back in the day, back in 2006. And that is why they are trying to find a new strategy. They are indeed, as has been said, they are trying to destabilize Hezbollah's power base by economically sabotaging Lebanon itself, by spreading misinformation through media and through their minions in Lebanon. But it is something that it's shaky at best. The way in which the Israelis are doing it now is at some points nearly amateuristic, because they are so uncertain on what they have to do and how they can take on Hezbollah on the battlefield.
Well, Jim, you talked about the destabilization, the attempt to destabilize Lebanon through economic means and social unrest. And, of course, the Secretary General of Hezbollah, Sayed Hassan Nasrallah, he addressed this and basically a message to the Israelis, don't try us, even though we have many, many problems, but the defense of Lebanon is the number one priority for the resistance. I want to talk about deterrence and the importance of that. If we see from 2006 until now that the Israelis hadn't attacked, do you think the tactics used by Hezbollah will continue to protect the country or not?
Well, I think that, Hezbollah, as previous guest and I have said, has built up its military capacity in such a way that it feels comfortable that it can reasonably protect the country and do damage, serious damage, and win perhaps and probably a military struggle against Israel. But these economic attacks are something else that are hard to counter in the way that, because the United States controls so much of the financial institutions of the world and the financial power of the world, that you can create a financial crisis, you can create an economic crisis, you can make it difficult to buy things on the international market, you can create shortages of electricity and meat, et cetera, And this is the attempt that the United States makes throughout the world in regimes it wants to change to create suffering among the people that they can blame on the regime. Now, in this case, you have the Americans and Israel trying to construct a narrative in which the problem is Hezbollah, okay? And, you know, that's going to resonate with some people in the sense that, you know, if there are people who don't care too much about the Palestinians in Lebanon, and there probably are some, you know, they're going to say, why should we be buffeted by this because the Hezbollah is there, you know, as a military threat to Israel. But I think that, as we've been saying, in general in the last few years, the unity of the resistance on behalf of the Palestinians has strengthened. So I don't think it's going to work. I mean, we have to be humble and aware of the fact that this is a lot of economic power the United States has, and they're using it, and it can cause disruptions and disunity. That's what they want to do. They want to divide people, and they want them to blame Hezbollah for the problems they're having.
Well, Brent, I want to look at another angle of this, because this time around there's growing solidarity among the resistance and its support for Hezbollah, from the Palestinian resistant movements to Iraq, Yemen, Syria, and Iran. They have all announced their solidarity and support of Hezbollah in fighting Israel. Your thoughts on this, the significance of this change this time around?
I think this is one of the most important developments that we have seen internationally speaking, and especially for West Asia in the past decades, basically, in the 21st century so far, is the development of a multipolar world order that has been spreading, has been developing all across the world, of course, with new superpowers and regional powers rising up and claiming their national sovereignty and their right to decide their own, to take their own matters into their own hands, away from the dictates of the United States and their allies. And this is, in the Islamic world in particular, this, of course, has been materializing in the Mukawama, in the Islamic resistance that has been spreading across the Middle East, across Western Asia, and which often in the Western propaganda is called somewhat of a Shia crescent, even though it's in order to portray it as in a sectarian point, of course, because that is as well, of course, is part of the propaganda mill in order to try to sow sectarian dissent and strife amongst the Muslim people. What we have seen in the past 20 years and what has scared the Western powers and the Zionists to such a massive degree is exactly that cooperation that we have seen between the Islamic Republic of Iran, the Syrian Arab Republic, the people of Lebanon, especially in Hezbollah. We have seen in Iraq, of course, ever since the conflict against Daesh, this has come to the forefront, the Hashd al-Sha'abi, the Popular Mobilization Forces, and other movements in Iraq who have been allying with this international movement of resistance against imperialism. And now, of course, in 2014, also the people of Yemen. This is something that has shown itself to be an extremely powerful strategy. And it shows the strength of solidarity across sectarian lines, across religious divides, across ethnic divides, against this war against Western Asia that has been going on for at least the past 100 years, ever since Sykes-Picot, the agreement between Sykes and Picot and the British and the French redistribution of Western Asian land between himself, and of course since the Balfour Declaration, in which they agreed, the Western powers agreed to basically steal Palestinian land and give it to the Zionists. This is a constant war against the people of Western Asia and against the spirit of Islam itself that has been going on since the end of World War I at the very least. And this is something that has been, this conflict has been waged with the West gradually, like generally winning over and over again for the most part up until the last couple of decades, when now the West has been defeated bit by bit and small battles at first, but bit by bit, gradually but steadily, they have been losing influence. And they have been losing to a variety of countries, a variety of political movements, a variety of religious groups, but who are all united together under the banner of anti-imperialism and the defense of the national sovereignty and of their national self-determination. And this is the most important thing that I that is going on there right now, and that is exactly why Iran is one of the most important blame factors in Western propaganda. Next to, of course, on a worldwide level, you have they blame things on Russia, they blame things on China, but everything related to the Middle East and to Western Asia in general, to the Arab world, will always be blamed on Iran. The war in Syria was blamed on Iran, the war in Yemen is being blamed on Iran, and the reason for that being that this Iran is seen, and rightfully so, I think, as some sort of a regional power and a regional hub of resistance. They have been uniting the powers of the forces of resistance, which we have seen beautifully during the inauguration of President Ibrahim Raisi, when people from all over the Islamic world came to Tehran in order to pay their respects and in order to basically congratulate the president on his election. This is a showcase of that global unity and that regional unity and collaboration, cooperation, and solidarity that has been growing in the area for the past 20 years.
And on that note, that brings us to the end of this spotlight. I appreciate both of you being with me. Author and journalist Jim Kavanaugh out of New York and historian and journalist Brett Yonkers out of Hasselt. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for staying with us.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The first of its kind suit alleges U.S. weapons firms design, market, distribute, and sell guns in ways they know routinely arm the drug cartels in Mexico. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Brett Wilkins, writer. This article is published under the heading Mexico Files Historic Lawsuit Against U.S. Gun Companies Fueling Cartel Carnage. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. In a historic move welcomed by gun control advocates, the Mexican government recently filed a lawsuit in a federal court in Massachusetts against American weapons manufacturers and suppliers, accusing them of negligent business practices enabling the illegal cross-border arms flow that contributes to Mexico's record homicide rate. The government of Mexico says the first-of-its-kind lawsuit filed in U.S. federal court in Boston seeks to put an end to the massive damage that the defendants caused by actively facilitating the unlawful trafficking of their guns to drug cartels and other criminals in Mexico. The lawsuit says almost all guns recovered at crime scenes in Mexico, 70% to 90% of them, were trafficked from the United States of America. At a recent news press conference, Mexican Foreign Minister Marcelo Ebrard said these weapons were intimately linked to the violence that Mexico is living through today. The previous day, Ebrard traveled to El Paso, Texas, to commemorate the 22 people killed at a Walmart store last year by gunmen who admitted to deliberately targeting Mexicans. The Mexican government, which linked more than 17,000 of the nation's 34,648 homicides in 2019 to trafficked weapons, is seeking compensation for as much as $10 billion in alleged damages. Companies listed in the complaint include Smith and Wesson, Barrett Firearms, Beretta USA, Colts Manufacturing Co., Clark, Anstrom, Roger & Co. For decades, the Mexican government and its citizens have been victimized by a deadly flood of military-style and other particularly lethal guns that flows from the U.S. across the border into criminal hands in Mexico, the suit says, adding, "This flood is not a natural phenomenon or an inevitable consequence of the gun business or the U.S. gun laws. It is the foreseeable result of the defendant's deliberate actions and business practices." The lawsuit continues. Defendants design, market, distribute, and sell guns in ways they know routinely arm the drug cartels in Mexico. Defendants use reckless and corrupt gun dealers and dangerous and illegal sales practices that the cartels rely on to get their guns. Defendants design these guns to be easily modified, to fire automatically, and to be readily transferable on the criminal market in Mexico. Defendants know how to make and sell their guns to prevent this illegal trade. The U.S. government and U.S. court told them how. Defendants defy those recommendations and many others and instead choose to continue supplying the criminal gun market in Mexico because they profit from it. The suit notes that Mexico has a strong domestic laws that make it virtually impossible for criminals to lawfully obtain guns in Mexico. Mexico has one gun store in the entire nation and issues fewer than 50 gun permits per year, the complaint says. Defendants undermine these stringent laws and wreak havoc in Mexican society by persistently supplying a torrent of guns to the drug cartels. It is estimated that more than 500,000 guns annually are trafficked from the U.S. into Mexico, the document states. Defendants produce more than 68% of those U.S. origin trafficked guns, which means that they annually sell more than 340,000 guns that flow from their plants in Massachusetts and other U.S. states to criminals south of the border. The Violence Policy Center, VPC, a U.S. nonprofit gun control group, has tracked thousands of weapons, including military-style assault weapons and high-caliber sniper rifles illegally trafficked from the United States into Mexico. VPC Legislative Director Kristen Rand told Common Dreams in an email that the U.S. gun industry must be held accountable for the devastation it produces, inflict in Mexico. The gun industry must not be allowed to turn a blind eye to the decades-long steady flow of U.S.-made guns that has terrorized innocent Mexican and armed violent criminal organizations, added Rand. This lawsuit is a major step toward holding a rogue industry accountable, he added. In addition to financial damages, the lawsuit seeks to compel U.S. gun makers to abate and remedy the public nuisance they have created in Mexico, create and implement standards sufficient to reasonably monitor and discipline their distribution systems, incorporate all reasonably available safety mechanisms into their guns, including devices to prevent use of those guns by unauthorized users, and fund the studies, programs, advertising campaigns, and other events focused on preventing unlawful trafficking of guns. Mexican Senate Majority Leader Ricardo Monreal, who, like Mexican President Andrés Manuel López Obrador, is a member of the Social Democratic Morina Pardi told La Jornada that the lawsuit is an unprecedented event that seeks to prevent the continued generation of this tragedy that Mexico is experiencing. Monreal said, "I am sure that many of our problems in terms of violence are caused by the illegal use and illegal introduction of weapons into our country."
From the heart of beautiful Iran, IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.